MacCast, Tuesday, December 29th, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. I hope you had a happy and wonderful holiday, whichever one you choose to celebrate or not. I had a pretty good one. It was nice to spend some time with the family over the holidays, although I think Santa, while he brought me the stuff that I wanted, I think he also brought me a cold, which I'm not too thrilled about. But we're going to try and soldier through this episode. We've got a few things to talk about. Things are pretty slow right now, actually, in the Apple universe. Not a whole lot going on as we're approaching the end of the year, but we do have a few things to talk about. Some rumors about Apple upping the audio quality in iTunes and possibly Apple Music. We'll talk about that a little bit. More details on what's happening next for the iPhone, and a little bit about Apple's encryption battle. Real short little news section in this episode, and then we'll get to some feedback. I'm going to talk about an interesting thing that happened at the Genius Bar. I know it sounds like a lead into a joke or something like that, but it's not. Actually, it's not even really that funny, but we'll get into that. I'm going to give you some tips on startup modes for OS X, and then I will have my thing of the moment. And it's a pretty good one this time around, especially if you're interested at all in getting into programming or maybe just a project to do with your kids. So it should be a lot of fun. Stay tuned for everything. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. Look, if you need to create an affordable website that looks awesome and you want to do it fast, then I'm telling you, Squarespace is all you need. It is an awesome service. They provide everything you could want, the hosting. You can get the domain name from them. They give you great looking templates that are completely mobile responsive, so they're going to look good on tablets or desktops or phones, whatever screen you might be looking at it on. And they give you the ability to completely customize the template. You can do drag and drop. You can go in with the WYSIWYG, or you can even drill down to the code level if that's your sort of thing. So they give you all the elements, all the tools that you need to actually build a great looking website, and they make it super easy. Look, I'm a web developer and I've used Squarespace on many of my own projects. I frequently actually recommended them to clients and friends, and everyone, myself included, have been super happy with the results. And you really can do everything on Squarespace. One of the great new options that they offer now is something called Commerce. And it gives you all the tools you need to build a complete online store. It's something I get asked about a lot. So you can put together a product grid. You can have galleries so your products look great. There's no transaction fees. They give you all the metrics so you can track your sales. And they even offer real-time carrier shipping rates if you choose the advanced plans. So everything all there in one package. And best of all, you can try Squarespace for free, no credit card required, and you're going to get a professionally designed site regardless of your skill level, no coding required. You get intuitive, easy-to-use tools, and if you sign up for a year, you get a free domain name. So like I said earlier, everything you need to get going. So to start your free trial site today, you can do it at squarespace.com. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code MACCAST and you're going to get 10% off your first purchase. So you're going to save money, have a great looking site, and I think you're really going to like it. So go try it out at squarespace.com. Squarespace, build it beautiful, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MACCAST. Kicking off things this week, we have reports that Apple is working to bring higher resolution, higher bitrate audio to Apple Music, and I would assume also iTunes, although the rumors seem to be mostly focused on Apple's newest streaming service, Apple Music. Now, this could actually also go along with some of the rumors that we've been talking about. You may have heard on past shows that Apple could be looking to replace the Lightning connector, or rather the 3.5 millimeter audio jack, with the Lightning connector for audio output, possibly on a future iPhone. Now, the rumors about the high-res audio are saying that Apple is exploring the idea of distributing Apple Music at 96 kilohertz and 24-bit. That would be up from the 16-bit 44.1 kilohertz that they're currently distributing. This report came from the Japanese site Mac Atakara. I think I said that right. Almost messed it up there. They claim that the information came from companies who are working with Apple and who were exhibiting recently at the Portable Audio Festival. So a little backroom conversations going on, and they're leaking a little bit of information. Now, as I was mentioning earlier, this rumor of the Lightning connector replacing the 3.5 millimeter jack is also giving this rumor a little bit of weight. And as a matter of fact, if you remember, Apple did announce a new Lightning connector audio specification at last June's WWDC conference, although so far only a handful of Lightning equipped headphones have actually surfaced. But a Lightning connector audio jack, or I guess digital audio jack, could allow for higher quality 24-bit digital audio conversion. So you could do higher DAC than you can with just the analog headphone jack. And another benefit of the Lightning connector is it could also deliver power and could allow you to use apps to control features within the headphone hardware itself. So you could potentially alter the headphone software and hardware and optimize it for higher quality audio, really get your headphones tweaked the way that you would like them. So a lot of people are somewhat excited about this, especially audiophiles. But beyond the audiophile world, I have to ask, does anyone really care about this? Is it really going to matter all that much? And if you follow Dave Hamilton at the Mac Observer, he actually wrote a great piece called Digital Music, Can You Hear Above 16-Bit 44.1 Kilohertz? It's a great read. I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes, and I recommend you check it out. But in it, he explains the idea of bit depth and sample rate and kind of makes a case why going any higher quality than the current 16-bit 44.1 kilohertz might be a moot point. And I thought it was good just to have a simple conversation here about the difference between bit depth and sample rate and why it might matter to the audio that you're listening to, because I didn't really understand this till I read Dave's piece. So a digital audiophile's bit depth determines its dynamic range, basically the difference between the softest and loudest sounds. And I'm oversimplifying here. And again, if you want the full details, go read Dave's piece. Now, according to his piece, based on research and evidence, 16 bits gives us a 96 dB or 96 decibel range, whereas 24 bits would give you 144 dB. Now, sample rate of an audiophile determines the frequency range at which sounds can be reproduced. Perfect fidelity reproduction is possible with a sample rate equal to twice the maximum frequency that you wish to produce. And why that's important, sounds a little technical, but why that's important is a 44.1 kilohertz sample rate can reproduce frequencies at up to 22.05 kilohertz. Right? So that's the sample rate equal to twice the maximum frequency you want to produce. The human ear in children, so fresh brand new ears, when you have good ears before you start losing your hearing, can hear from about 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. So at 44.1, you're already in the range that most people can hear at 44.1, 16-bit. And that's a fact that's been proven over and over by studies, by double-blind tests. They've definitively proved that most people cannot hear outside that range. Now, audiophiles and certain people can, so there's a small percentage of people that can tell the difference, but most of us, we really aren't going to be able to hear that, and as we age, things are going to get even worse. Now, for recording and for mixing, it's a little bit different. It's kind of similar to the way the idea that you want with other forms of digital production, right? Higher bit rates are important for the actual source material, for the recording. We do the same thing with film, right? You're going to shoot movies at 4K or 8K. You're going to shoot your camera files. If you can, you want to put them in RAW format. You want the best quality going in. If you're recording, you're going to want to record at higher sample rates, higher bit rates, like 24-bit. It just makes sense so that your source material, you have as much data as you possibly can, because you're going to take that and you're going to distribute it at a lower format, 1080p or 4K for video. You might send out JPEG files for your photos or 16-bit audio. And it's because in all cases, the human analog receptors that are going to be taking in this information, our eyes, our ears, all those things, we're inherently flawed. We're not perfect. We're not as good as the technology coming in. And so therefore, most of us can't tell the difference between these things. So why waste the bits? More importantly, with audio and video, why waste the bandwidth or the storage, the file sizes and things like that, to get extra data that our brains and our receptors really can't use? And this makes sense to me. You know, why would we want to go beyond this? Well, Apple actually has a reason. So that's the interesting thing about this, and why I'm sharing this story with you, is because I think there is a little bit of possible truth to it. And the best way I can explain this is with two words, which is information bias. And it's about marketing. It's about bullet points. If someone tells you, hey, this is better quality, and you choose to believe it, then you will start to perceive that that thing is better in many, many cases. And this has been proven over and over again as well. It's information bias. So you will start to even maybe say you can tell the difference when really you actually can't. And even when science and studies can prove that you can't, you'll still say, but I really think I can tell the difference. And it's a natural human thing. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not weird or anything like that, but it's what we do. And why that's important to Apple is that those two words are a big bullet point plus when it comes to getting us to buy new stuff, right? We always want better. And if we perceive it to be better, then we're likely going to buy it. So if Apple Music can say that they have a higher quality bitrate, higher quality audio file than their competitors, that's a leg up. If the iOS devices have technology in them, like audio through the Lightning connector, that is pure digital audio, and they can say, we're delivering it at higher bit rates, at higher fidelity through the Lightning connector, maybe you're going to buy a set of new Lightning connector headphones. And guess what? Apple sells headphones, Beats. So you better believe that Beats are going to support newer, higher quality, higher bitrate Apple Music, optimized for Apple Music. You're going to be able to hear and tell the difference. And whether you can or not, you're likely to believe it, and you are going to probably buy new stuff. And that's good for Apple's bottom line. So there's also the added benefit that, you know, audiophile customers, they tend to buy more music than the average consumer. So if Apple can say our music quality on iTunes is higher bitrate, it's high resolution, they might get more audiophiles and more people who care about that stuff buying more music. Again, adding to Apple's bottom line. So placebo or not, Apple really, I think, does have a vested interest in selling more products and services. And if creating a high res, quote unquote, audio bitrate can accomplish this for them, then they likely are probably going to do it. And we're hearing rumors that they're at least experimenting with it. And I have no doubts that they're doing that. So we'll just have to wait and see. 2016 could be the year that Apple introduces high-res Apple Music audio files. One other quick related story on the music front. Apple has filed trademarks, apparently, for additional Beats radio stations. They have trademark filings for Beats 2, Beats 3, Beats 4, and Beats 5. This didn't really come as a surprise to me. I'm not sure if it comes as a surprise to you. I fully expected, if Beats was successful, that Apple would want to put out more radio stations. I would assume they'd start to build them up around different genres, different shows, and things like that. It doesn't necessarily mean just because they have these trademark filings that they have new stations planned, but I think they probably do. Whether or not we'll see them soon or ever, who really knows? But my guess is that if Beats 1 really is successful, and that still remains to be seen. At this point, I think only Apple really knows if it has been a success or not. But if it is successful at all, I think they're going to want to put out additional stations. And luckily for Apple, in this report, it said that their licensing terms with the record labels already include permission to create up to 5 additional radio stations with the existing content that they have licensing for. So it's not going to be too hard for them to expand. I think the only thing would be is that if they're playing more music, that means more streams. And I believe the licensing is done per stream, so they might be paying out more money to the record labels, which is good for the record labels and probably keeps the relationship good. So maybe we'll be getting new Beats radio stations sometime soon. Along with this, I'm kind of curious if you listen to Beats One at all. I listen a little bit, but honestly, not that frequently. But I'm just curious, for those of you in the audience, is it a regular place that you go to get your audio files? Or if you're using Apple Music, are you more like me? You're just checking out the new section and the recommendations and things like that and going with those. That stuff I actually consume daily as I sit here and I work and things like that. I love listening to Apple Music. I've even started to use it in lieu of my own music collection. And I've started to actually discover new things and build out my music collection, which I think is exactly what Apple wants. So I've been very happy with Apple Music, and it's going great for me, but I'd be curious to get some feedback from you. So shoot me an email, let me know. Audio files are very much welcomed, maccast@gmail.com. We have a little bit more information this week on what might be next for iPhone. Specifically, the very next iPhone is looking to be the iPhone 6C, although some people are calling it the iPhone 7C. I think 6C is likely what Apple's going to do, but we've heard some reports otherwise. And so far, we've heard that it's going to be a 4-inch version of the iPhone. Many of you have written me and said you're looking forward to a smaller version, smaller updated version of the iPhone. It would have a similar curved cover edge glass like the iPhone 6S line currently does, and will reportedly come in 2 or 3 color options. I would think 3. Anodized aluminum casing. I don't think it's going to be the, you know, typical silver, space gray, gold color scheme that we see with the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus line. I'm thinking if they go with colors, it's going to be bright colors, more fun like the iPhone 4C was, or 5C rather. 4C. No, I don't think there was a 4C. We're also hearing that the updated iPhone 6C will have an Apple A9 processor. So there were some earlier reports thinking that it might have been an A8, but it looks like Apple is going to keep it up to date with the latest processor technology. 8-megapixel rear-facing camera, a 1.2-megapixel front-facing camera, 802.11 AC Wi-Fi, and Bluetooth 4.1. Pretty typical specs that we'd come to expect from Apple. It will also have Touch ID, but no 3D touch. Now, these are all things that we've heard before, but this week we got a couple new rumors added to the iPhone 6C stuff. That is that it might have a slightly larger battery than the iPhone 5S, which is the phone it's expected to replace. 1,642 milliamp hour battery versus 1,570 milliamp hours. And because the display size is going to be the same and likely the same technology, I would imagine that means a little bit more battery life, assuming it's not eaten up by the extra, you know, newer processor that's in there. And even more interestingly, part of this report says that Apple could bump the RAM in the iPhone 6C up to 2 gigabytes, which would match the rest of the iPhone 6 line, which that would be cool. And it would mean, I think, a little bit better performance for the iPhone 6C. So it's going to be no slouch of a phone when it comes out, and it should be priced comparably to the iPhone 5S. As far as when we might see it, we got a little evidence of when that might happen from China Mobile this week. They held an event discussing their upcoming plans for 2016, and there was a slide that seemed to indicate that April 2016, Apple would have a new device on their network, and many are assuming that is the new iPhone 6C. Apple is also expected to have a special event in March where they would be announcing probably the Apple Watch 2, but they could also unveil the new smaller iPhone 6C at that event. So timing seems to be lining up for a April-March launch of the iPhone 6C. And I had originally thought that the timing of this rumor kind of threw it out a little bit. It seemed odd that Apple would come out with the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus line and then have the 6C following along, you know, the next year, about 6 months later. But the timing might make sense if some of what the analysts are saying right now, it turns out to be true, because they're predicting that Apple will have an unusual iPhone sales slump in the first quarter of 2016. Now, most of the predictions are coming based on supply chain indicators. And, you know, historically, Tim Cook has said, don't trust the supply chain, but they're still looking at that. And what they're seeing is Apple slowing down production of the iPhone 6S series units. So there's less coming out of the supply chain, and that's getting them a little bit nervous. They're thinking maybe Apple is dialing it down because they're not selling as many devices as they thought they were going to sell, although it really could just be that they already have enough supply in channel to kind of keep up with demand. So they could just be ahead of the curve. But some analysts are looking at that saying, look, they're slowing down. We can expect that the numbers in the first quarter might be a little bit lower than usual. So a spring launch of a new device could actually help bump up sales and maybe offset that a little bit in Apple's lineup. And I have a feeling, you know, a device like the 6C at a lower price point is going to do very well for the company. Still, over the holidays, though, Apple was able to gain the most mobile device activations, according to Flurry Analytics. So the holiday quarter seems to have gone pretty well. 49.1% of all new devices activated were Apple devices, and that number is slightly down from last year's 51.3%, but not significantly. So Apple having a pretty good holiday quarter, expecting maybe a little slide as they go into the first part of 2016. But I think ultimately with a new device hitting the market and some other things that we're going to talk about, I think they're going to be okay. Now, what can we expect in the fall when Apple has their usual iPhone event and we get updated iPhones? Well, the iPhone 7, of course, but what is that going to look like? Rumors coming out now are telling us it's likely going to, well, I think it's obviously going to have a new Apple A10 processor. Be interesting to see. Are they going to call it an A10 or an AX? That might be a little bit confusing because we've had the X series like A8X and those sorts of things in the past. But anytime we hit that 10 number, I'm curious how Apple will go with the branding. It's also expected that the iPhone 7 might bump up the RAM, at least in the Plus model. We're hearing 3 gigabytes of RAM in the 5.5-inch phone, but Apple will stick with just 2 gigabytes in the standard iPhone 7 model. DigiTimes is also reporting that Apple's chassis component supplier is working on new designs. Now, usually in these even years is when we do get a case redesign or redesign of the product. This time around, it's looking like the materials might be up for some changes. And one of the reasons for that is there's a claim that they want the iPhone 7 series to be completely waterproof. That would be a very good thing, something that's been a long time coming, I think. They're also saying that Apple might be looking to incorporate the antennas into the case so that we don't have to have the little antenna lines anymore. And if you've listened to the show for a while, you know I'm not a huge fan of those. I've gotten kind of used to them over the last, you know, couple of years of iPhones, but it'd be nice to see that go away and have more of a sleek, slim design. One thing I'm not so sure I'm happy about is they say the way Apple might achieve that is by using new compound materials. And that could mean that Apple is possibly moving away from a metal case for the iPhone. I really like the feel of the metal case, and they didn't give a lot of specifics about what these compound materials would be. I know in the past, Apple's played around with things like ceramics. I hope they're not thinking about maybe going back to plastic, because I don't think that gives it the kind of premium feel that I really like. But we're going to have to wait and see, but certainly there's going to be some sort of redesign. And on the water resistance thing, Apple has been slowly improving the water resistance of the iPhone. If you remember, the latest iPhone 6S designs added new gaskets and silicone seals. They're a lot more water resistant than units have been in the past, but a big challenge still is all of the ports and the areas around connectors. Those are the biggest issues. And as we talked about earlier, if Apple's able to actually eliminate the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack, that's going to mean one less hole for them to plug as well. So as much as I didn't kind of believe that rumor at first, the more of these other rumors that sort of come in behind it, I'm starting to believe it a little bit more. The Lightning connector, I don't think has an opening, right? It just goes so that you can get at the metal contacts, but they could have a much easier time sealing that port off than maybe the headphone jack. And as far as getting back to some of the iPhone sales, Apple seems to be having a rough time in India, and according to some sources, is cutting prices because of it. Back before Christmas, Apple cut the prices on the iPhone 5S, actually in half. They dropped the price in India from 44,500 rupees, which is about $665 US, down to 25,000 rupees, or about $370 US. Now, the Times of India is saying that Apple has dropped the prices of the new iPhones, the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus models, about 16%, and they say it is in response to lagging sales. Now, the Times piece says that Apple was hopeful when the iPhone first hit India back in October because sales appeared to be going strong, but since the launch, things have declined quickly. In October, Apple was believed to have shipped about 320,000 units to the region, but now shipments have dropped 62% and are down to around just 120,000 units. This is according to numbers from November. The India market is pretty important to Apple. They really want to capitalize on it. It doesn't have the same size and is not quite as rapidly, and they don't have the same rapid growing middle class as China, so they're much more price sensitive, but they are the world's fastest growing smartphone market. And another issue that Apple is having in the region is that import taxes also drive up the costs of the unit. And another thing that's going on is that Foxconn has had plans to build 10 to 12 factories in India by 2020, Foxconn being one of Apple's primary suppliers for iPhones. It's not really clear at this point if any of those factories are going to supply products for Apple, but if they could, that could go a long way to bringing prices down in the region. And Tim Cook recently had talks with India's prime minister, and they did reportedly discuss the possibilities of doing local manufacturing. So Apple obviously eyeing India, and they are making some adjustments and changes to make sure that the iPhone continues to do well in that region. And India really does seem to be price sensitive at the moment. And between price drops and the rumored iPhone 6C, which could also help in that region, Apple is definitely responding to those concerns. And there's just one more item in the news that I want to talk to you about this week, and it has to do with Apple and their little battle with the U.S. government over encryption and privacy and those sorts of things. And I typically don't like to get into these issues too much because they get a little bit political, but I'm trying to approach this from the tech angle, and I'm going to do my best to be impartial, although it may come out that I do have a side in this sort of thing, and you probably won't be surprised if you've heard me on other podcasts to find out what side of this I'm on. I mean, I am a tech nerd after all. But part of what triggered this was Tim Cook did a recent 60 Minutes interview, actually a bunch of the executives at Apple, including Johnny Ive, that was a little bit fluffy. I thought it was going to be a little more in-depth and a little bit more hard-hitting, something coming from, you know, 60 Minutes, you would expect that. But, you know, it was a little kind of fluffy piece. They asked a few questions, but didn't dig too much into some of the issues Apple's been involved in. But one cool thing about that, if you didn't catch it, is we did get a glimpse of the inside of Johnny Ive's design studio. That is a part of Apple that people don't get to see. And so if you want to see that, you should watch the 60 Minutes episode. It aired recently. You can actually watch it for free on the CBS app, or you can get it through the CBS website, although I think on the website you have to use Flash. And they also showed off at the end some of Apple's new spaceship campus, including showing a big glass panel, one of the massive glass, you know, curved glass panels going into place in there. And so there's some fun little stuff in there, but, you know, don't expect any hard-hitting news coming out of it. But one thing that Tim Cook was asked about was the encryption issue. It's been heating up, and Apple is kind of caught in the middle of it. Now, in the 60 Minutes thing, he just basically gave his canned response that, you know, Apple believes that we have the right to our security and our privacy. And they're by far the, you know, not the only tech company that is involved in this debate. Google and Facebook are also in the government's line of fire. Now, the basic issue is that Apple and these other companies have been securing our devices to better protect our data, our privacy, and our information. And that's a really good thing. But the issue for the governments has been that the same protections that are keeping our iMessages safe and private, and our banking information safe and private, and our credit cards safe and secure and encrypted, those same technologies that are built into our iOS devices are being used by bad guys also to evade law enforcement and government agencies. And the government essentially wants a way to get at that data if they go through the right channels and, you know, get a subpoena and do all those things. They want to have the ability to get decrypted access to that information. They want a backdoor. But the issue is that a backdoor that would be used to catch criminals is really more like a revolving door, because it would also let criminals get at our private data. So if your iPhone gets stolen and somebody wants to steal your credit card information or your banking information, if there's a backdoor, criminals are going to be able to get in the same door that the government would be using to track down those criminals. So it's a real dicey issue. And recently in the United Kingdom, they proposed an investigatory powers bill, and I think we talked about this on a prior episode, that would effectively make it impossible for Apple to keep the protections and encryptions in place that they have and still be able to sell iPhones in the United Kingdom. And so this is bringing up all of these issues again. And obviously Apple is fighting against that bill. They don't think it's a good idea. I think just this week, they put out a statement imploring the UK government to sort of reconsider some of the stuff that's in that bill. And, you know, I am falling on the side of, I really like having my data and my information private and secure. So the problem is if you decrease the privacy and security in our devices so that you make it easier for governments and law enforcement and people to catch criminals and bad guys and terrorists and stuff like that, you also risk making it easier for that personal information to be hacked and for identity theft and fraud to take place. So you're kind of trading one problem for another. And when Apple looks at that situation, they say, no, look, the right thing to do, we believe, is to protect the privacy and security and information of our customers. And if that impacts the government's ability and law enforcement's ability to, you know, fight and track down the bad guys, then that's just a consequence of that. And we're not doing anything wrong. And that's where the debate has gone on is, you know, does Apple have a responsibility to make sure that they're not protecting criminals and bad guys and things like that? And that's sort of how governments are kind of framing it, which I think is a wrong way to frame it as well. I think there's no doubt that Apple does not support terrorists or pedophiles or criminals or any of these sorts of people, and they're not putting these technologies in place to accomplish that. They're putting those technologies in place to protect the majority of their consumers who are law-abiding, good citizens who use technology products and care about their privacy. And with a backdoor, even if Apple were to put that in place, and this is just how I sort of see things, even if they put a backdoor in place for the government, one, it makes it easier for criminals to do more crimes. But the other side of it is, as far as catching criminals go, they're just going to find another way to protect their communication. And there are plenty of ways without iPhones, without other technology, you know, without existing technologies that they can do that. And it's not that hard to implement. They would just go back to older ways of doing it. The only thing that the iPhone has done has made it easier and given them a off-the-shelf product that they can kind of do that stuff with. But by taking that feature out, what you're really doing is making average customers and a lot more people around the world vulnerable to attacks and hacking and getting their privacy and their information taken. And I don't think that is ultimately the best thing to do in the long run. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I'm especially interested to see what happens with this bill in the UK. And I know many of you live in the UK. You're probably following this a little bit more closely. If you want to chime in on this issue and send us some of your thoughts, I would appreciate that. You can send me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. But I really don't know what Apple is going to do if this bill passes, because they're not going to want to change the iPhone in a way that's going to impact the rest of their customers all over the world, but I'm not entirely convinced they're going to want to have to create an entirely different operating system or different variant of the operating system just for one region of the world. So it could get very, very interesting, and certainly this debate is heating up. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, rather, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. This week, I want to talk to you about Text Expander. If there is one tool, one piece of software that I have installed, I guarantee you on every Mac, every iOS device that I own, and that is usually the first or second app that I install on those devices, it is Text Expander. Text Expander is awesome because it lets you create snippets of text in almost any app that will expand into larger bits of text. And it's also great because there is so many ways you can use it. I use it to set up shortcuts for expanding addresses. So business address, home address, those sorts of things, just in a couple keystrokes, boom, I can insert that in any document, in any email, anything that I need to do. Same thing for signatures. I also use it to automatically add accents to words, so I don't have to remember the keyboard shortcuts or the combinations to get little accented characters. Those happen automatically. Just type the word normally, and then Text Expander kicks in. You can also use it to fix common misspellings. A big one for me is I'm often swapping the O and A in downloads. So I have a Text Expander snippet that's just the misspelling, and then it auto corrects it to the right spelling. And you can also use it for things like autocomplete for code. So I'm a developer. You can set up autocomplete snippets for all of your code, and then it works in any app. You don't have to be in your special code editor just to get auto completion. You can do all that with Text Expander. And now with Text Expander 5, they make it even easier to figure out what shortcuts to set up because they'll suggest abbreviations. It'll keep track of things that you type and say, hey, I see you type this thing all the time. You want to set up a quick Text Expander snippet for it. And that's exactly what it's for. It's for those things that you type over and over again, and you can do it now in less keystrokes. It actually saves you time. Cool little feature it has in there too is you can actually go in and get statistics on how much time you saved by using Text Expander. And then once you've got all of the basics down, there are great power user features in there as well. So you can get things like fill-in fields, so you can dynamically change text on the fly at expansion time. There's optional text, so if you have different variants of a thing, maybe a reply that you're often giving in an email, you can turn on or off different sections of text at expansion time. And you can even go all the way through to true power user features like integrating AppleScript. It's a really cool application. You can also use your snippets on your iPhone and iPad with Text Expander Touch and the Text Expander Custom Keyboard. And you can sync all of your snippets through Dropbox and iCloud. So if you have multiple Macs or Macs and iOS devices, all of your snippets can be with you when and where you need them. So visit smilesoftware.com/maccast. You can download a free demo of Text Expander, try it out, and you can improve your communication today. Great software from Smile, and a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. Okay, this next story is one that came up because of an email that I received, and unfortunately, this email was cause for some concern, and I wish it was the only time that I've had a report of something like this happening, but it has to do with Apple and the Genius Bar. What was going on is Laurent was troubleshooting a Mac and noticed that some of the files had a user listed on them called Wheel. And you may or may not be aware that because the Mac is based on a Unix operating system, you have different users and groups and permissions and things like that on your files. It's all pretty much kind of hidden from us most of the time. But if you select a file in the Finder and choose File Get Info from the menu, or Command I is the shortcut, in the little info window, you can look down under the Sharing and Permissions section, and you can see a list of users and groups and the permissions and kinds of access that it has for those files, usually read, write, or read and write permissions. So Laurent was looking in there, and noticed that a lot of the files had a user listed as Wheel, W-H-E-E-L, like the wheel of a car. And he thought, well, that's a little bit odd. I don't understand what this Wheel user is, and did the logical thing and made a Genius Bar appointment. He was having trouble with his Mac and thought, you know, I'm going to go down. I'm going to ask the Genius Bar people for advice on how to proceed on this. You know, did I get hacked? What is this weird user that I'm seeing? And unfortunately, this time, rather than getting the correct advice from the Genius said, I don't understand what that Wheel thing is either. And apparently there was some recommendation to actually remove the user or change the permissions on the file or something like that. And then Laurent could no longer boot the Mac. And needless to say, that was really bad advice from the Genius Bar. And so this is kind of a story of when a genius really isn't a genius at fixing your Mac. And it happens rarely, but it does happen from time to time. So I want to talk about what happened, why it happened, what the Wheel user, or more correctly, Wheel group is, and what, if this happens to you, you could do to fix your Mac, or if it happens to someone you know, you could do to potentially fix their Mac. And as I was mentioning earlier, the first thing you need to know is, despite all of the pretty UI and the ease of use and everything beautiful in OS X, under the hood, it is a version of Unix, actually one based on the Berkeley Software Distribution, or BSD, version of Unix. And Unix, the operating system, is designed from the ground up to be a multi-user operating system. And because of this, it has a history of user security built into it. There's a lot of different users and groups, and those users and groups have different permissions within the system, and that each one of those users and groups is kind of set up to ensure that things are siloed off, that each kind of user and type of user only has permission and access to the things that it needs access to, and not more than that. And in general, OS X manages all of this for us, and which is why it's mostly hidden from most of us. So you may be hearing about these users and groups for the first time, or maybe you've heard it before. Probably you've heard on this podcast and many others, or even on many other Mac tip sites, about repairing permissions. And very often, you know, the troubleshooting step in the past when you had problems specifically with user accounts was, hey, go in and run disk utility and repair permissions. Now, in OS X El Capitan, we don't need to do that anymore, and we've already discussed that. But that probably is, for most of us, the only context where the idea of users and groups and permissions ever came up in the past. But needless to say, they're central to the operation of OS X and the operating system. And even further in El Capitan, Apple has taken the system protections and the user accounts even further in terms of how they're restricted. And in OS X, they restrict access to specific groups and controls in the form of System Integrity Protection, or SIP. And you're starting to hear more and more about SIP and how it's affected developers and apps and things like that. But SIP basically protects certain system processes, things that OS X needs, and further restricts access to specific groups and controls, protects files and folders from being modified or tampered with, really system-level stuff, by other processes, even when they're executed by the root user, which is like the user with the most permissions on the system, or when you use a user account and do something called sudo, or get sudo permissions or higher-level root privileges. SIP protects against that kind of stuff. So within the OS X operating system, there's all these protections and controls and groups. And in the case of the Wheel user, the one that you were seeing, Laurent, it's actually a group that is, or has been in the past, critical to the operating system. And as you discovered, removing it or messing around with it can cause problems on your Mac, can make it completely unbootable, which is why the advice from the Genius wasn't really good advice. And I did a little more research in this because it'd been a while since I looked into it. And it turns out that Apple stopped using the Wheel group after OS X 10.3 in favor of a newer group called Admin. But I went into the terminal and I kind of looked through the operating system and I looked at some files in my system. And even though I'm running OS X 10.11 El Capitan, there were still a lot of system files that were listed as being in the Wheel group. So I don't think it's been totally expunged. the question in my mind comes in that I'm not sure if it's totally needed or, you know, what the permissions are, but these files and things that I saw in the wheel group are also mostly owned by the root user of the operating system. And obviously root still exists and it would have read write access. The interesting thing about the wheel and the admin groups is the only user in those groups is the root user. So it's unclear to me what the current relationship of wheel is in the current operating system, but it does seem clear based on your evidence and experience that removing the wheel group from files or completely removing it from the operating system can certainly break the OS. So long story short is don't remove or modify the wheel group or the admin group or probably any of the groups for that matter. Now, let's say what happens, as is in your case, Lauren, you do, right? What can you do to recover? Well, I would say the very first thing is make sure that you have a recent full backup of your operating system, just in case anything goes wrong. But the procedure I'm going to walk you through should be pretty safe. So the next thing to do would be to boot your Mac into recovery mode. So hold down Command R while starting up your Mac, and that should put it into the recovery partition, into recovery mode. And then from there, you should be able to run the OS X installer and reinstall OS X right over top of your existing system. So it shouldn't do anything to your existing files or anything like that. That should all stay in place, your user accounts, account settings, all those things. Really, what we just want to do is restore, in essence, that wheel group or any of the permissions or any of the base operating system stuff that maybe got damaged when the wheel group was removed. So reinstall the OS right over top of the existing system, and you should be back up and running. So relatively easy fix. It should have been minor damage. I don't think anything horrible happened. But in the future, you probably want to make sure that you leave the wheel group and the admin group and all those things in place. And then finally, I guess the last thing to talk about is what do you do if you encounter a genius who makes a mistake or isn't necessarily a genius? And I really want to say, you know, this is probably something they just had never encountered before. They didn't have the experience. Apple does send all these people to training, but maybe it's just something that got missed. We all make mistakes from time to time and we give the wrong advice. I've done it on this very podcast and had to follow up with corrections. You've maybe heard some of those in the past. And so that said, if you do hear advice or you hear something that just in the back of your mind seems iffy or strange, you might want to go get a second opinion, ask to see another genius, ask them to maybe confirm with another genius that, hey, is that really the action or the thing that I should be taking? And unfortunately, you might not always know that you're being given the wrong advice, or maybe it didn't even seem that suspicious. You thought, okay, yeah, this looks like a rogue, weird account. He says to delete it, I should go ahead and delete it. And that's where having good backups might be the only way that you can get saved. So goes back to my longstanding thing of make sure you have a number of good backups for your Mac. And then if you get into real big trouble, you can always, of course, just reinstall the operating system and restore from your backups and you'll be back up and running. So many ways to keep yourself safe. And I'm sorry you kind of got that bad advice, but hopefully there wasn't too much damage done this time around. In working on an answer for Laurent, I came across a really awesome Apple support article that I'll link to in the show notes on startup key combinations for the Mac. And I've known about a lot of these for years, but I've never really delved into the specifics of what each one does and how you activate it and how you use them on the Mac. So I thought that would be a good thing to cover in this episode. Again, these are for Intel-based Macs only, which should be Macs that most of you have. If you still have a PowerPC Mac that you're using, bless you. You're awesome. That's really cool. But these aren't going to work for those older Macs. They only work for Intel-based Macs. So I thought it'd be cool to kind of run down these different modes that you can boot into. The first one being safe mode, and that's pretty straightforward. All you have to do is hold down the shift key while you're booting your Mac, and that will boot it into safe mode. I think when you boot up, it even says safe mode on the screen. And it's a way of starting up your Mac so that it performs certain kinds of checks. It also prevents some software from automatically loading or opening. So it verifies your disks, attempts to repair any directory issues if needed. So I don't know if this is like a full repair permissions kind of thing, or it's probably more like a FSCK repair or scan that we'll talk about doing manually a little bit later through one of the other modes. But basically, it's a good way to kind of clean up your disk and directories and stuff like that. It will also load only required kernel extensions, basically just the ones that were needed by the system. So if any third-party apps put any of those in place, it's going to shut those off. It's going to prevent any extra startup items or login items from opening up automatically. It will disable any user-installed fonts, and it deletes your font caches, your kernel caches, and other system cache files. So if you're having any kind of corruption or issues with those, if you're having any issues with conflicting fonts, if you're having any issues with background processes or startup apps or third-party kernel extensions, it's going to weed all of those out. So this can be a really helpful mode to boot up into if you're having issues with your Mac, maybe spinning beach balls or crashes, kernel panics. You can boot into safe mode, run your Mac for a while, and see if those issues go away. If they do, then you at least know where to start looking. And that can be a good thing. And it can clean out caches, which might be corrupt, so it just might solve your problems altogether. So booting into safe mode, hold down the shift key while booting your Mac. The next thing that you might not know about is the startup manager. So this is enabled by holding down the option key while booting your Mac. And what'll happen is it will bring up a list of all the volumes on your Mac that have a valid operating system, basically all of the drives that you can boot off of. So that could be your internal hard drive. It could be a clone backup, like a Super Duper or a Carbon Copy clone backup. And it could be a USB key, maybe that you have an operating system or an installer put on. So this is a great way, if you're having a problem, to boot off of a different disk to maybe do some additional troubleshooting, things like that. Somewhat related to this, another startup mode that you can enable is booting up to a bootable CD, DVD, or USB thumb drive. You can do that by simply holding down the C key while booting, and it will find that operating system or that bootable drive and boot off of that. That's kind of an older one. We're seeing less and less Macs with optical disks these days, but maybe you still have some USB keys that you've built with OS X installers. So if you want to do a clean install or something like that and boot off a USB drive and you don't want to go through the startup manager, you could simply hold down the C key. Another kind of lesser known one, and one that I've used occasionally but rarely, is booting into the Apple hardware tests or the Apple diagnostics mode. Now, if your Mac was made before June 2013, when you use this, you're going to boot into Apple hardware test. If it's post June 2013, you're going to get Apple diagnostics, but they basically do the same thing. And the way you boot into this mode is you hold down the D key, D as in dog, when booting your Mac. And this lets you run Apple's hardware tests, so you can check out your hardware. So if you suspect you're having an issue with your RAM or maybe your graphics card or the logic board or controllers or ports or any of those sorts of things, you can use the hardware test mode or the Apple diagnostics mode to check that. And I think it takes a few minutes. There might even be a couple different kinds of tests. So you can run a quick test and there's a more intense, longer test. One thing you're going to want to make sure that you do before running this is disconnect any external drives, any other peripherals except your mouse and keyboard and your display, and Ethernet adapter if you're doing a wired connection to the Ethernet. But you want to disconnect any external optical drives, third-party hard drives. You don't want any extra accessories, just Apple accessories hooked up. And because it can take a little while to run this, if you're using a laptop, you want to make sure that you're plugged into AC power. And incidentally, if you hold down Option plus D when you're starting up, you can actually run these tests over the internet, assuming that you have a valid internet connection. So you don't even have to boot off of your system drive. You can actually run these remotely from the internet. And that would be good, I guess, if you were having specifically a hard drive issue. Maybe you can't boot from your hard drive, but you suspect that that is your hardware problem. You could use this to check that out. Maybe it's the controller, the connector, something like that. So that's the Apple hardware tests. Another one that you're probably, most of us are never going to use, but if you work in a large corporation, you might use, is called NetBoot, booting off a NetBoot server. And the way you activate this is you hold down the N key, N as in Nancy, at startup, Or if you hold down Option and again, you can boot off of a default NetBoot server image. So normally holding N, it would boot off the NetBoot image that's been set up for your Mac. Option N would boot off a default boot image. And again, this is a way to boot from OS 10, from the operating system off of a server on a network rather than off of the local hard drive. And it's used mostly in corporations by IT departments and things like that. One that you're probably pretty familiar with, most people are if they've been using OS 10 in the last few years, is recovery mode. So holding down Command R to boot to your recovery disk. And of course, this lets you reinstall the operating system. It lets you run things like disk utility, lets you set a firmware password on your Mac. It's really not advised unless you know what you're doing that you actually set a firmware password, but you can do it from the recovery volume. And again, if there's something wrong with your hard drive, maybe your hard drive's gone totally dead and you can't boot off of your recovery disk because that's just a partition on your main hard drive, you can hold down Command Option plus R and you can boot to recovery mode over the internet. Another thing that's really, really handy. Another startup mode that you can enable is resetting your NVRAM or your PRAM, as people call it. Hold down Command Option plus PR during startup until you hear the startup chime again and then release it. Now, I'm old school, and back in the old days, we used to do the chimes four or five times. I typically let it reboot four times, but that's probably just voodoo. I don't think it's really needed. I don't even know if it was needed back then, but I'm still in the habit, so maybe four chimes is good luck, I guess. I don't really know. But what this does is it clears the non-volatile RAM access memory, the NVRAM, which holds certain kinds of settings like your speaker volume, your screen resolutions, your startup disk selection, also recent kernel panic information, if there is any of that, is stored in there. And if you're having issues with any of these settings or things, typically if you know you're having a problem with display or your speaker volume, you know, is not coming up when you press the button, something like that, maybe you have some corruption in those settings, and that's how you clear that stuff out. So you can do that. Another helpful boot mode is single user mode or verbose mode. To enable single user mode, you hold down Command S while starting up your Mac. For verbose mode, you hold down Command V during startup. And these both basically do the same thing. They put your Mac into command line mode. So when you have these held down and your Mac is booting up, you'll see all of the Linux or Unix operating system stuff, that BSD stuff, showing up on your screen. It almost looks like you're booting into an old version of Windows or something like that. And if you have File Vault enabled on your Mac, you will have to go through the pick a user account screen first, kind of that gray screen, and enter your password to unlock the disk before it'll let you enable single user mode. But single user mode can help you potentially see any startup issues because you see all of the system stuff loading on the screen. So if there's an error or something like that, you'll see it during the boot time, and normally you can't see that stuff. Another helpful thing that you can do once you've booted in a single user mode is right on screen, it'll give you some instructions for running what's called the FSCK or FSUC command, which is a command that you can use to check the directories and stuff on your hard drive. Again, I think it's probably the same thing that enables when you boot into safe disk mode automatically. It's just when you're booted into verbose or single user mode, you have to activate it manually by typing in a command. But again, it'll get to a certain point, you'll see a command prompt, and it'll give you the instruction for actually running that if you want to check out your disk. And then the only difference, I think, between single user mode and verbose mode, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong on this, is that verbose mode will also show you everything that's happening during shutdown as well as during startup. So during startup in both modes, you'll see the stuff on the screen with, if you've enabled verbose mode, once you shut down your Mac or reboot it, you'll see all of the instructions that are happening during shutdown as well. And then another mode that is useful to boot into from time to time is target disk mode. To do that, you simply hold down the T key while you're booting up. And what this will do is it allow you to put your Mac in a mode where you can connect it to another Mac with a FireWire or a Thunderbolt cable, and then the two Macs can see each other. Well, more specifically, the target Mac, the one you've put into target disk mode, will actually mount as a hard drive on the Mac that it's connected to. So you can go in and you can browse all the files on that disk. Target disk mode can be really helpful if your Mac is not booting up and you just need to get at the files. Maybe you haven't done a backup recently, or there's some files that you haven't archived. You can go grab those maybe before you have to erase the drive and reinstall the operating system, something like that. Or it's just really handy if you want a kind of quicker, faster way to transfer some files from an old Mac to a new Mac, something like that. The last thing is not really a boot up mode as much as it is a convenient little way to eject a removable media volume. If you hold the eject key, the F12 key, the mouse button, or the trackpad button while booting, not all at the same time, but one of those while booting, then you can eject any removable media that you might have, like an optical disk. Again, a lot of us don't have optical disks on our newer Macs, but if you had a disk in there and you wanted to eject it during boot up, you could do that by holding down one of those keys or buttons. And that's pretty much it. That's all of the special modes and kind of how you activate them and use them. I thought that was really cool and useful information, so hopefully you found it enlightening as well. And then finally for this episode, I have my thing of the moment. I'm kind of excited about this one. I've actually talked about it a little bit in the past in a past thing of the moment pick, but it was kind of a side thing. It was just part of it. And it was when I talked to you about the Sphero Spark, which is a version of Sphero targeted at the education market, specifically teaching kids how to code. And the app that I want to talk to you about today, that's my thing of the moment this week, is an app called Tickle. And it is for iOS, for iPhone and iPad. And it basically lets you write your own programs on iOS. But unlike, you know, having to go in and learn Swift code or Objective-C or something like that, this is really targeted at teaching kids how to program. But it is actually amazing, even as an adult, the kinds of things that it gives you access to on your iOS devices. It gives you a whole host of tools and an easy way to build simple little programs, but it gives you actually a lot of power as well, because you have access to all of your iOS device sensors. So like the tilt sensors, the gyroscopes, the touchscreen, you can program all of those events and build little applications right within the Tickle app. And it goes even further, because if you have other real world connected devices, Wi-Fi devices, Bluetooth devices, things like Spheros or Ollies, or even if you have like the new Sphero BB-8, you can write programs in Tickle that can trigger events and interact with those physical devices. They also have support for a lot of the Parrot drones. So if you have one of those, Philips Hue bulbs. So if you want to write your own program to control your Philips Hue bulbs, you can do that with the Tickle app. Dash and Dot robots, or even an Arduino, the Arduino Bean. You can use this app to create little programs that interact with that. And basically when you launch it, what you get is you get some samples. They have some online videos to get you up and running, but it's basically a visual programming editor. It takes the block methodology. So if you've ever used Scratch or a program like that, you're given all these little preset building blocks that you drag out onto a surface, and then you kind of connect them together in sequence, and it writes the code for you. So you're not really writing code as much as you are putting out little building blocks of logic and then filling in the information. But it's enough to kind of get you used to certain basic programming concepts like loops and if-then statements and variables and events and triggering events and receiving events, all these sort of basic concepts. Again, remember, it's really targeted at younger children and getting them comfortable with the ideas and concepts around programming and objective programming. And it works really, really well. They give you a library of animated characters and sprites. So again, you can build on-screen little games. You have characters that you can move around on the screen. You can build buttons that cause actions to happen. events to happen. So you can trigger movement, you can trigger sound, you can trigger your physical objects to do things. So you could literally program a button in the app that would turn on and off your Hue bulb, or you could build a little control that would allow you to adjust and change the colors, or you could have it where you have a little character on screen, and when you tilt the iPad and move him into a certain section of the screen, that would trigger something to happen with the BB-8 Sphero, or it could trigger a Hue bulb to start flashing somewhere in your kid's room or something like that. Really neat stuff. And so they have motion things that allow you to move sprites and objects around the screen over time. They have looks, which are controls for color and visibility and scale of objects on the screen and effects. They have sounds, so you can trigger sounds. You have access to the accelerometer, the pitch of the device, the gyroscope, all kinds of events, logic statements and loops, so you can loop forever. You have the sensors like the iOS touchscreen. And if you have physical objects, you can even access things like the shock sensor that's in the Sphero. So when the Sphero hits the wall, you could actually have that trigger something in your program. A character could jump in the program, or the color of the Sphero could change. All these sorts of things you can capture. And of course, you have operators and variables and the ability to do counts and math. It is just a fabulous way to get into programming. And I think it's really, really well done. And it's really worth checking out. Best of all, the app is completely free. So you can download it, play around with it. You don't have to have any of the physical objects. You can just write programs right in the app. And if you have any of these extra things, it's really cool to see. I can actually write a program on my iPad that can control a physical object that I own. Just a lot of fun to play with. I've had a great time with it and really wanted to make that my recommendation, my thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. I do have one favor to ask you and one other thing to talk to you about. First, the favor. The favor is, if you listen to the MacCast on Android, recently when I upgraded to OS X El Capitan, I had to change my production workflow a little bit. I'm using the newer version of GarageBand, which doesn't have support for the enhanced AAC features, the chapters and all that sort of thing built into GarageBand anymore. So I'm using a third-party app to actually put that stuff in place. And when I made that change, apparently a number of you who listen on Android told me that you could no longer play back the enhanced AAC files. Now, if you've run into this problem, you're having this issue on Android, the workaround is you can go to the MacCast.com website and you can get access to the MP3 feed. You'll have to copy that URL into your podcasting app on Android and put that in place, but then you'll just get MP3 versions of the show, and those play fine on Android. But where my favor comes into play is I worked with the developer of the app I was using, and they sent me a beta patch, a fix that should fix the issue on Android. So if you've been having playback issues with the AAC files, the stuff that comes from iTunes on Android, specifically I've heard from people who are using the Pocket Casts application, but it looks like even directly playing the AAC files from my website doesn't work on Android either. If you've had those issues, can you go back and test and check a recent episode on your Android device and see if it will play back? And if it does or doesn't, please report back to me and let me know, because I'd like to get this issue fixed for my Android listeners. So that's the favor. Now, the other thing that I wanted to say is we're reaching the end of the year, and I just wanted to give a big thank you to you for listening to, supporting, and being a part of the show, being a part of the MacCast community, because I really could not do this show without you. And it's now been 11 years that I've been doing this podcast. It was 11 years as of December 13th. And it's just amazing how long the show's been running. And the fact that I'm able to do this, I am just incredibly appreciative of you and your support in whatever way you do that. Simply listening to the show is all you need to do. But if you've sent in an email, you've sent in an audio comment, you've made a comment on the website, in the comments section, or you've been a part of the MacCast forum or on Twitter or however you've been a part of the show, I just wanted to say thank you, and I really appreciate it. It's been a great 11 years, and I look forward to 11 more if that happens. I don't know how long we'll keep doing this, but as long as you're listening, I'm here willing to do the shows. So it's been a great ride, and just thank you, thank you, thank you. And secondarily, I wish you a very happy and safe new year and look forward to 2016. So next show, we'll be back in 2016, and it'll be a whole new year and another year of MacCasts to put out. All right. With all that done, quick thanks to all of my sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's great software at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. I love having you be part of the show. The way you can do that is you can send an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. You can also do it by calling in on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. Or if you're a Skype user, you can leave voicemail on Skype. And my Skype username is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That is at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. You can also follow me online if you're on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Google+, twitter.com/MacCast. The Facebook page is at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And the Google+ community is google.com/plusMacCast. All pretty easy to find. You can also just Google for that stuff. And I look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.